Welcome to Heino's Home Show. We're so glad that you've joined us again. We love that. We are brought to you by the fine folks over at Accurate Mortgage Group. If you're looking to buy a house, refinance a house, give them a shout at accuratemtg.com. You can also find them at heinoshomeshow.com, and they'll get you closed and back to life. Joined as always by the fine, great, most wonderful, I'm running out of adjectives, but Encyclopedia Steve is here with me again today.
Thank you, Heino. I'm so appreciative of that.
Yeah. So you've had a good week so far?
I have had a jamming week. It has been so much fun to be in the mortgage business right now. And if you talk to anybody who's in the business or has a friend in the business,
we're all busy and not getting much sleep. That's kind of what's going on right now, yep. Which is good, right? I mean, can't complain about that.
Absolutely.
It kind of got me thinking about just in general about mortgages, about how long they've been around. Where did that concept even start? You know, I mean, because we take it for granted that you want to buy a house or something, you go to the bank, you get a mortgage, and boom, you're a homeowner.
Yeah.
But that wasn't always the case, right? I mean, that's not really been around for really the way we know it now that long.
Well, yeah, it's kind of funny because it's one of those things that has been around in one form or another for a long, long time. And as long as anybody who's been alive, mortgages have been around in one form or another.
Right.
I mean, the origin, and it's funny, you call me Encyclopedia Steve. I'm not really a history buff, but I love a good origin story.
Yeah, me too. Especially if there's a superhero involved.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So with mortgages, I mean, mortgages have been around for thousands of years in one shape or another.
Yeah, I mean, I think even like the ancient Greeks and Romans, I mean, they had some form of mortgage even way back then.
Yes, absolutely. So the way, and this is the way the Romans actually defined it, they adopted the concept of a debt security by assigning the possession of the property to the creditor while the debtor remains in control of it until the debt is repaid.
So that's basically a mortgage. So right. Yeah, so the home or whatever it was, the ownership is assigned to the person who lent the money, but the borrower could use it while they were making payments, and then once it was paid off, the possession got turned back over to them. That's exactly like what we do now.
Yep.
You know, with car loans and auto, you know, house loans and everything, you know, you got to use it, although you technically don't fully own it.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny. We use kind of this different terminology for a mortgage loan as we know it compared to things like car loans, like you said.
Yeah.
It's really that same concept, really. Like, you have an asset and you're using that asset as collateral to get the money to purchase that asset.
Right.
But you're the one who gets to use it as long as you pay the bill on time.
Exactly.
That's the important part.
And it's funny how more aware, like, the younger generation is about concepts like that. Because I made some comment the other day about it being my house, you know, to my kids. And they're like, well, the banks, really. You know, I'm like, well, you're right. But, you know.
Well, it's not really the banks. The bank owns a certain percentage.
Yeah, I know.
I own the other percentage.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I was going to get into, you know, the details with them. But yeah, I mean, what, the 1930s or so? I mean, before that, most people weren't really homeowners at all. I mean, it was like the really wealthy could afford to get a right. house. They probably, you know, Rockefellers and stuff, they probably just plunked down some cash or, you know, big chest of gold or whatever it was that they had. But I think only like 4 in 10 Americans even owned a house back then.
Yeah.
So not that many.
Yeah. Yeah. It was way less than it is now. So like back in the Industrial Revolution, because this was my thought when we started looking into this, like what was happening prior to a lot of people owning homes? They just rent. So back in the Industrial
Revolution. Or they just chopped down a bunch of trees and built a log cabin on the prairie.
Oh, there you go.
That's, you know, they did that.
Yeah. So a lot of these big manufacturing companies, you know, the Rockefellers and the JP Morgans and all that sort of thing, they would actually build properties close to where the factories were that the workers would then rent from them.
Right, right.
So that way they were close to where
Old
they had
Hickory
to go to work.
Here is built on that. All those houses were built for DuPont back in the early part of the century.
There you go. That's a perfect example. So that was what happened before. When all this really started to change, when the concept of like home ownership in America became a real big thing, was really right after World War II. So back in the 1940s, you know, there was the baby boom. Everybody was having kids. We had just won the Second World War, and America was really like steaming along really good, right? there was a lot of emphasis put on investing in America and investing in yourself. And that's when homeownership really started to pick up. And there was a lot of innovation that started to happen during that time in the mortgage market to make it easier for people to get their first home.
I think before that, even the concept of a subdivision wasn't really a thing outside of the factory town that you were talking about where they built housing for the workers there. But the concept as we know it today, where they found some big chunk of land and they built 200 houses on it, and hey, everybody go live there.
Yeah.
That kind of started right around that time when they started to build little subdivisions.
Yeah, absolutely.
So around that time, what I understand is that people's debt to income ratio as it relates to the mortgage, how much their housing payment took up of their income, went from like 20% and at one point was even as high as like 73%. So people were like, the vast majority of their income was going to pay for their house.
Yeah.
Which was a big deal. Was a really big deal.
Yeah, because that really changed, you know, that changed the perspective of how people were spending their money. You know, like we mentioned it, the idea of investing in America and investing in your home, that led to people kind of swinging the pendulum to the opposite side. So whereas a lot of people, you know, who could afford homes had made a lot of money and were able to afford that very comfortably, whereas it then went to the other end where people who were not necessarily as well off were able to get financing to help them buy the home.
Yeah.
The amount of money they were making compared to what they were having to pay to stay in the house was taking up a lot of their income, but they saw that as a vehicle to create wealth.
Yeah. And I think probably up until that point, many people lived in town, you know, close to the town center. And at that point, people started moving a little further out. Housing started getting a little further away. And that's when the subdivisions and the whole concept of the suburbs happened. Because before then, it was like town and country. You know, and then there really was not much more of a delineation other than that. You know, it was just town, the city, and then, you know, not the city. And then it slowly the city started creeping out a little further and further, but it was more of a bedroom community type of situation the further out you got. And people were buying houses. And then the government got involved and started helping people buy houses. And that's a whole other thing that kind of spurred things on.
Right. Well, and also something too that I think people forget is the automobile is actually a big part of the reason that we've been able to spread out as much as we have.
Yeah.
So America is really a country where we're kind of built, you have to have a car, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. So with a car, that allows you to decide, okay, how far am I willing to drive in order to get to where I have to work? So how far away can I live? So people started seeking out that cheaper land and maybe a little bit more land because now the area they were living in was getting crowded with people building houses. So the automobile actually is also what drove a lot of this throughout our history. And as automobiles became more fuel efficient and faster and more comfortable, like it just made people's experience of being in them and willing to commute every day, it just allowed a lot more flexibility in the way that we started to grow our country.
Yeah. It's interesting that for the longest time, for decades and decades, the only kind of mortgage that there was your standard 30-year fixed rate loan. And that was it. That was all you could get. And it just kind of got me thinking, how did they come up with 30 years? Why 30 years? Why not 40 years? Why not 20 years? Why was it 30 years? How did they land on that?
That's a really interesting question, actually. And that, you know, the most amount of mortgages that are done in the United States are 30-year mortgages.
Yep, so it
was kind of the first, and it's really stuck around. And the reason for that is because most people were expected that when they buy a house, that was going to be the house they were going to live in for the rest of their lives.
Okay.
So for 30 years, you were expected to be working during that time frame. So essentially most people, you know, they would grow up, either graduate from school or maybe they were helping on the farm and then they were going to go buy their own house. So they would be in their early 20s. It was expected that they were going to work for another 30 years before they eventually retired. And a lot of that was based on life expectancy. You know, you want to retire at some point so you can at least enjoy yourself. So the idea of doing it over 30 years was because that way you could have the payments as low as possible so that you could gradually pay it off during your working years. So that once you did retire, the house was now yours and you didn't have to worry about working to pay that bill every month.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't until like, I think the 80s that the whole concept of an adjustable rate mortgage came about. probably in response to the fact that rates were kind of crazy high at that point. In fact, I have a little cutout of an ad that was run back in 1985, I believe, and it advertises rock bottom rates at 12 and three quarters for only 2 points, you know? And it's like, yeah, so, they were pretty high, and so the payments were pretty high, and not many people could afford them, so the whole concept of the adjustable rate mortgage came in because you had those lower introductory rates.
So for somebody who's maybe never actually done an ARM or talked about an ARM, they're just, I always do a 30-year fixed. And if that's you, like, that's a lot of people.
And for the record, an ARM is an adjustable rate mortgage.
Yeah. So explain a little bit about how that works. Like, what does it mean when your rate's adjustable as opposed to fixed? Because most people know what a fixed is.
Yeah, but fixed means it doesn't change. But on an adjustable rate mortgage, it's usually the way they work is that it's fixed for a certain amount of time. Let's say a 5-1 ARM. So you'll see it written as a 5/1 ARM. That means that it's fixed for the first 5 years, and then it adjusts once a year after that. And depending on the loan, it might adjust up or down. It might have some caps on it where it can adjust at the most 1% up or down a year, so on and so forth. And then there's a lifetime cap where it can't go up more or down, let's say 5 points. So you can never get higher than, if it started out at 3%, it maybe can't ever get higher than 8% or something like that.
Right.
But even that's newer. When they first came out, a lot of them didn't have caps, and they could, if the market went nuts, all of a sudden you had a mortgage payment that was a 10%, interest rate. Maybe you started out at 5% or something.
Yeah.
Right now, there's not hardly any of that going on because just regular fixed rates are low enough right now that you can't hardly go any lower. So it makes no sense to get an adjustable rate at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, that's a little bit of a history of how mortgages came about and why they're even at where they're at now. We're going to get into a little bit more of that. We're going to take a quick break right now, but we're going to come back with a whole lot more of Hino's Home Show. So you come on back. Welcome back to Hino's Home Show. We, of course, are brought to you by the fine folks over at Accurate Mortgage Group. You can find them at accuratemtg.com. We're, of course, talking mortgages this week and kind of the history of them and why they came about and how it got to be where it's at now. By the way, Steve is joining me here, Encyclopedia Steve. One thing that really surprised me was that before the Great Depression, mortgages were renegotiated every single year. That would freak me out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you absolutely imagine?
No.
Every year you're like, hey, what are we going to do this year?
Yeah.
What's my rate going to be now?
I know. See, as a homeowner, that would freak me out. Using homeowner's insurance as an analogy, that usually doesn't fluctuate a whole lot. It kind of stays pretty flat.
And it's not your single biggest bill either.
Right. Exactly.
So,
So
I thought that was pretty interesting.
We had mentioned in the previous segment that during this time, the Great Depression, only like 4 in 10 people actually own their homes.
That's right.
So if you were to take the amount of people who have mortgages now and try and do that every year, you would never be able to give any new mortgages because you would just be doing the same ones over and over.
Yeah. So I guess the Great Depression, that probably caused property values to just really sink.
Yes.
Really go down because so many people were out of work. Even if they had a prayer of buying a house beforehand, they didn't now.
Yeah, no way. Well, yeah, and we've talked about this on shows before that the mortgage market operates on risk or perceived risk. Mm-hmm. So when things are stable and things are slowly going up, we don't want to go too fast in any one direction. That kind of freaks out the mortgage market. What happened in the Great Depression was, obviously, like you said, home values plummeted. And so mortgage lenders were afraid to give people loans because they may loan you, back then $15,000, which was a lot of money.
Oh, less than that. Yeah, probably. Yeah.
And, all of a sudden the home's going to be worth half. That's super risky. Like there's not a lot of stability in that. And that's super risky.
Well, that's lenders. About the time the government started to get involved in the whole mortgage business.
Right. Exactly.
They started guaranteeing loans. That's when the FHA was actually started, was right as a result of the Great Depression. FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, Actually, the Fannie Mae was actually started back then too. That's the Federal National Mortgage Association. That was all started back then as a result of the Great Depression. They were trying to promote homeownership. The government stepped in and started saying, all right, we'll help out.
Yeah, and really, that's kind of where this concept of like a government-insured or government-backed mortgage really came from. So the reason that mortgage lenders were willing to get back into the market during the Great Depression is because the government was basically backing those mortgages.
Right, and there were so many loans in default, again, because of the Great Depression, the government stepped in to help supplement those and to subsidize those, and then lenders were able to reinstate a lot of the mortgages that were in default and kind of get them back on track.
So as the Great Depression was wrapping up and World War II was taking place, and that's really what brought us out of the Great Depression, right?
Right.
So from that is when really the mortgage market started to take off. And part of that is due to the GI Bill, which a lot of people are familiar with. The GI Bill is for our vets. So a lot of people had gone off to war and the government said, hey, thank you for your service. Thank you for everything that you provided for us. We're going to give you some additional benefits coming back to help continue to grow the country. And
right. So, and help them buy houses and buy homes for their new families that they're hopefully coming back to.
Right, exactly. So one of the things that was probably the most influential or had the biggest ripple effect on the mortgage market was part of the GI Bill allowed homeowners who were veterans to buy a home with only 5% down.
Yeah, before that, 20% was mandatory. You wanted to buy a house, you had to put down a 20% down payment, and that's the only kind of mortgage there was.
Right, and still today we hear people say that, like, hey, I thought I had to have a 20% down payment, and now that's really just not the case. There's so many different products out there that can allow you to get into homeownership for less than 20% down.
Very true.
And all of that is thanks to the GI Bill.
That all started with the VA. Yeah.
Yep.
So then what's Ginnie Mae? How did that come about?
So in 1968, Ginnie Mae emerged to bring uniformity to the mortgage market. And what the concept was, which a lot of people have now heard of, is securitizing mortgages. So essentially, they were packaging mortgages together so that they could then be sold on the secondary market.
But in order to do that, they had to make them more uniform.
Right,
because exactly. Otherwise, they were all over the place.
Right. So mortgages, each individual mortgage is a little bit different, but like 90 or 95% of it's going to be the same kind of across the board. That's where you get these idea of guidelines, right?
Right.
So Ginnie Mae is actually who kind of spearheaded that venture into making capital available to people and then also helping investors on the back end.
Right. And pretty much all the government loans, your FHA, VA, USDA, they all fall under Ginnie Mae.
Right.
That's a lot of A's going on there, but they kind of all fall under that government loan administration.
Yeah. And really, so the big concept to think of when we think of how Ginnie Mae founded, because shortly thereafter, actually, Freddie Mac was founded, for people who are familiar with that term. I think it was 2 years later in 1970.
Yeah.
So this was really the dawn of mortgage-backed securities. So that's really the big thing that happened in this. And Ginnie Mae and Freddie Mac, they've all kind of morphed throughout the years, but like this was the one pioneering thing. And this really brought about a lot of big changes in the mortgage market, I think for the better, because it gave more access to capital for people. But as we'll talk about, there were some downsides to what ended up happening.
Yeah, before that, I think most lenders held their own mortgages.
Right.
So they lent the money, they collected the interest, and you know, I don't know how they went out and found more money. I guess they just had a lot of money. But it wasn't until this happened with mortgage-backed securities that lenders now had an outlet to go sell that mortgage, get their money back, go do more mortgages.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and a lot of people think about doing things with your local bank, right?
Right.
And one of the questions that we get asked every once in a while is like, hey, are you the person that I'm going to make my payments to every month? Well, way back before Ginnie Mae started, that usually was the case. You would go to your local bank down the street and the bank would use the money that people had in deposits to turn around and make mortgages.
Right. Just watch It's a Wonderful Life and you'll know exactly what we're talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly. Yes. I love that movie. And yeah. I think I'm just biased because it's about banking.
Yeah.
It's really a good movie. But yeah, they do talk a lot about banking. It's a cool thing that movie really does that a lot of other movies don't, unless it's specific to like, you know, some different events that have happened throughout the
right.
years.
Wolves of Wall Street or something.
Yeah, exactly.
So Fannie Mae has existed since right around the Great Depression, but Freddie Mac, the other big agency for conventional loans, that was established in 1970. So why did they come about? Why do we need two of them?
That's a really good question. So part of that has to do with the American ideal of capitalism and promoting competition, right? So Freddie Mac came out as a response to Fannie Mae and saying, hey, we've got a better idea. We can do this a little bit better, right? Eventually, both started as government entities and then eventually became private. And now they're actually back the other direction, and they're what's called a government-sponsored entity. So they're not really part of the government, but they're just backed by the government.
They're not really private. They're this weird middle ground.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's kind of happened throughout the history. But part of that was just a different concept on the same general idea. And so Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac now, you know, especially after the crash of 2008, they do a lot of things very similar. There are some variances, but, you know, really,
they're pretty minor. Their guidelines are virtually identical. Everything's virtually identical.
Yeah.
So it's sometimes I wonder, it's like, well, how come there's two of them? Because they're the same.
Yeah.
Except they're not.
Right. Yeah. I think I honestly now, based on the way that they operate now, because they used to be fairly different, you know, compared to what we know them as now, they used to be very different. But now I agree with you that, you know, they're really kind of the same thing, and they're just operating in the same market under the same management of this, you know, government sponsored entity. And they're just making minor tweaks to things. But generally speaking, yeah, it's kind of the same thing at this point.
We haven't really even touched on USDA loans. That's fairly new. I mean, I didn't realize that, like, 1994, they've only really been around since then, because before then it was just the Department of Agriculture. And then in 94, they reorganized and became the USDA Rural Development Program. And that's when they started offering loans and started promoting, people buying farms and buying agricultural property and more rural areas and kind of promoting that.
Yeah. There was a law that was passed during the Clinton administration that really focused on promoting homeownership and giving even further access to capital to people that needed it. So the concept with this was people kind of more in the more rural parts of areas where they didn't necessarily have access to like a local bank, or, you know, properties were all a little bit different, which we've talked about in with previous guests of ours, how much different it is to buy a property that's, you know, a little further on the outskirts of town. So this concept was put into place to promote more homeownership. I mean, really, throughout our country's history, we have just declared that homeownership is something that's very important to us. And throughout different periods of time, we've done additional things to help people achieve that idea and ideal of homeownership.
And now, I think at one point, not too long ago, like the early 2000s, about 43% of all loans were a government loan. So FHA, VA, USDA. What is it now? Do you know?
I want to say it's somewhere right around that framework right now, but it has fluctuated a lot. So like during 2008, 2009, right after the crash, that actually spiked up to something like 70-something%.
70% of all loans were government backed.
Yeah.
Probably because lenders were afraid to make loans at that point.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, where these government entities came up was in the Great Depression. And then flash forward to 2008, we have the Great Recession, which was very similar but happened for different reasons. There was a real need for stability in the mortgage market. And having these government-backed loans brought stability to the market because lenders knew that the government was going to back them up. So that was a reason there was a huge spike in market share for government loans during that time.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we got to take a quick break, but we're going to come back with a whole lot more of Hino's Home Show. So stick around. Yeah, welcome back to Hino's Home Show. We are brought to you by the fine folks at Accurate Mortgage Group. If you're looking to buy a house, refinance a house, check them out at accuratemtg.com. They'll get you closed and back to life. We talked about in the last segment kind of how all the government loans came about, but pretty much anything that's not a government loan, Steve, is considered conventional.
Yes.
Or sometimes called traditional. mortgages.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. You know, pretty much anything that's not a government-backed loan really kind of falls under this umbrella of conventional or traditional is a good way to say it. I like that verbiage. That's an easy way to look at it.
Basically, anything that's not being subsidized by the government. You know, a loan that you would get through, you know, your bank or that kind of thing. You know, we as mortgage lenders, we do all of them, you know, all the different kinds. But once upon a time, you had to go to a bank to get a conventional loan.
Right.
And that's what you got there. And it was sponsored by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, you know, the two government-sponsored private institutions that we've talked about in the last segment.
Yeah, and that's kind of where it gets a little bit into the weeds.
I know.
Because we just said if it's not backed by the government, but these are government-sponsored entities.
Well, they kind of set forth the guidelines that everybody has to follow, even on a conventional loan, if you want to be able to sell it to them later on.
Yeah. So a lot of this terminology, like the conventional terminology, has been around for a long time. And when it came about, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were not government-sponsored entities. So that's why it doesn't fall under the government category, because it's been private for a majority of its existence. But currently, it is under this sponsorship agreement with the government. So the government doesn't actually back it from a traditional sense of like default, which is really when people think of a government loan being backed, is if the homeowner is going to default and stop making payments, the government is going to make sure that that lender gets all of their money back.
Right.
That's what we mean by that. So even though Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are actually sponsored by the government, they're not actually making any lenders whole if the homeowner defaults.
So they're sort of private, sort of government. They're kind of like the post office. It's not really a government agency. It's kind of a private agency. It's kind of this weird hybrid.
Yeah, like a quasi-governmental.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. It's definitely weird.
Now, one thing that I think confuses a lot of people is that you hear the word conforming, and most people, I did at one point, thought that a conforming loan meant that it's a conventional loan. But that's not exact. They're not interchangeable. All conforming loans are conventional, but not all conventional loans are conforming.
Yeah, so
it's a little confusing.
It is. It definitely is. So what is the difference between conforming and conventional? Will you explain that?
Sure. So conforming really just means that the loan conforms to the loan limit size that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have put forth. There's a few different levels, and it varies by county, you know, around the country. But around here in Nashville, $510,400 is the loan limit for just your standard conforming loan. And then it can go up to $563,500. Where'd they come up with it? Why don't they just round them off? I don't know. But that would be a high balance loan. And then anything above that is going to be a jumbo loan. And so that's not conforming. Anything above that is not conforming, but it can still be a conventional loan, but it doesn't conform to their loan limit size.
Yeah. So you mentioned that very, very narrow piece between 510 and 563 is high balance. So let's talk about high balance for a second.
Okay. Because we have a lot of that going on around here.
We do. Yeah. So this idea of high balance is high balance should be easier to qualify for than jumbo. Jumbo is when you start getting into these huge loans, sometimes in the millions of dollars. High balance never goes over $1 million. I shouldn't say never, but most of the time does not go over $1 million. And if you have questions on that and you want to get one, call us.
Yeah, we'll help you out with that. But yeah, 563.5 is the high balance limit for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Right.
So in our area.
Right. And so the point of that is to say that certain areas are a little bit more expensive to live in, which is why Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac give this high balance cutout. So like in Williamson, Davidson County, our limits are a little bit higher because, as most of you know, if you live here, it's more expensive to live in those counties.
But if you live in one of the counties that are a little bit further out, the loan limit size might actually be lower.
Right. So if you think of a place like California, like Los Angeles or New York City or something like that, the high balance limit actually goes up to like $729,000.
Yeah.
So those areas are even more expensive to live in. And so Fannie Mae gives a little bit of additional help. So long story short, high balance is anything over that conforming limit in a high cost of living area. So if you don't live in a high cost of living area, you probably never even heard of a high balance loan.
Right. And you don't need to, because the house that you want to buy, if you live in that area, doesn't even go up that high. So you don't have to worry about it.
Right. Or you're going to jump into jumbo. And then that's a whole different animal. And that's a fun one, but it's just very different.
It is very different. You gotta have a much better credit score. You gotta have better debt to income ratio. The qualification standards are stricter.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with a huger amount of money.
Right.
I mean, if you're gonna borrow $2 million, then, you know,
we want to make sure you're good for it.
Exactly. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, you know, there's a couple of reasons for this. One, obviously the big dollar amounts involved. Like a lot of people couldn't even fathom having a mortgage for $2 million. Like
I knew a guy once, and he had a mortgage that big. And I just asked him, you know, how big's your mortgage payment? And his mortgage payment was 30 grand a month.
Wow.
And I was like, okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, he could afford it, but you know, right. It just made me sweat.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, and even like when you get into a house that big, not only is the mortgage payment bigger, the taxes are bigger.
Oh, all of
the
it.
Insurance is bigger. I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah, we laugh about that. My wife and I laugh about that sometimes. You see some of these ginormous houses in Brentwood, and it's almost like if somebody gave us that house for free, we couldn't afford to keep it, you know, because the taxes are so high and just all the upkeep and everything that goes along with having a house that big, we couldn't afford it, even if we got it for free.
Right. And so as a result, something that happens is these homes stay on the market a lot longer. The buyer pool for people who are going to buy that home is a lot smaller. So think about it this way. Like, this is the reason that jumbo is a little bit more complicated, is because let's say we as a bank are willing to lend you $2 million for your $4 million house, right?
Right.
Well, if for some reason, let's say you lose your job and you just stop making payments, or your company goes under and you can't afford it anymore, and you just give the house back to us. Well, now we're sitting on a property that's worth $4 million.
It's going to be tough to sell.
Exactly. So there's a lot of risk involved when you get into some of these higher balance amounts, or higher dollar amounts, I should say. I don't want to confuse high balance and jumbo. When you get into that, there's a lot more risk for the lender. And that's why it's a lot more individualized, the qualifications. And it depends a lot more on the individual. And you have to be a much more stable borrower in order to get it. Whereas, you know, we've talked about this before. If you've got a home that's worth $250,000 in Nashville, that's going to sell like the same day it goes on the market.
Yeah, because so there's not that many of them, and the demand for them is huge.
Right.
Huge. Right. A lot of people looking to buy those houses. The whole concept of 100% financing, though, that is pretty much a government loan idea. I mean, on the conventional side of things, you're not ever going to get 100% loan,
right,
where you finance the entire value of the house. So VA loans can go up to 100%, and USDA loans can go up to 100%. But on the conventional side, not so much.
Yeah. And this technically doesn't really fall under the conventional side, but a construction loan is really kind of the only type of loan where a bank is willing to lend you more money than what the property is currently worth.
Yeah. 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 Because the house is going to be worth a lot more when it's finished than it is now.
Right.
You know, so if you're building a $200,000 house, hopefully by the time it's done, it's worth a lot more than that, you know, based on the other houses in the area, maybe $300,000, maybe $400,000. So in that sense, you're kind of financing 100%, but not really, because,
right,
you know, it's based on two different things, what it costs to build and what it's going to be worth later on when it's done.
Right. And so for anybody who's done a construction loan, you'll know that the interest rates on construction loans are a lot higher than what you would normally pay on a regular mortgage.
Which
is
why once the construction is done, you get out of that loan.
Exactly.
And you refinance into just a regular loan now that the house is done.
Right. And the reason for those higher interest rates is because for that 6 month or 4 month or 8 month, depending on how big and fancy your house is, for that period while you are building the house, it's not worth what we're lending you the money for.
Right.
I mean, until it's done, it's not actually worth $400,000.
It's just a pile of 2x4s and a piece of land right now.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why you see higher interest rates on that. And again, that's why once you're done with your construction loan, you do a more traditional mortgage or a conventional mortgage.
Now, on the conventional side, there's a couple of great first-time home buyer programs, both through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that allow you to put down a smaller down payment of only 3%. That's like the lowest down payment available on a first-time home buyer program is 3%.
Right. Other than the government stuff.
Other than the government. Well, other than the 100% loans, but even FHA loans are 3.5%. So on a Home Possible or Home Ready loan, you can put down only 3%, but it has income limits and some pretty strict qualification standards. So I think right now the income limits around here are about a little over $64,000. So it doesn't take much in a two-person household
right.
to exceed that limit.
Yeah, it's actually one of the limits is 80% of the median income in your area.
Right.
So depending on where you are.
That's going to change.
Right.
But at least it's available for people to be able to get into a home, their first time home. And just so you know, what they qualify as a first time home buyer is anybody who hasn't been on title on a home for 3 years.
Yes.
So if you owned a home 10 years ago, you can qualify as a first-time home buyer.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's something that most people don't know about.
Yeah, well, listen, we need to take one last break, but we're going to come back with more of Hinos Home Show, so stick around. All right, welcome back to Hinos Home Show. I always like that song.
I do too, actually.
That's yeah. Well, thanks for listening. We are brought to you by the folks over at Accurate Mortgage Group. Find them at accuratemtg.com if you're looking to buy a house or refinance a house. We've been talking about just kind of the history of mortgages and stuff. And the mortgage industry has had a lot of ups and downs over the years. I mean, there's been booms, there's been busts. You know, right now, I guess we're in a boom, it seems like.
Yeah.
But there's been a few busts. When was like the first time everything like fell apart?
I would say in the U.S., the most notable one or the first notable one was definitely during the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Which
we talked about. Yeah.
Right. We've talked about that. So, and that was kind of where the modern mortgage market started when you had the creation of all of these different government entities, right?
Right.
So as we go throughout history, there's several different booms and busts. So one, of course, happened in the 70s with the oil embargo, and that really wasn't a problem with mortgages. That was really just an economic downturn.
Right. It really hammered the economy pretty hard.
Exactly. Yeah. So that didn't have as big of effect as some of the more modern ones. So the next one after the 70s that a lot of people will probably remember is the savings and loan crisis in the early 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that.
So a lot of that came from ARMs being introduced in the 80s, which we talked about.
All those adjustable rate mortgages. And at first, there weren't a whole lot of regulations on them or caps. So they could just keep going up and up and up and up.
Right.
And they could change a lot more than 1 year. They would change month to month.
Right. And they were really just too complicated for people to understand. You know, there wasn't enough regulation around it. Like you said, people didn't understand what they were getting into. There were no protections in place. And so a lot of people got into trouble. So that was the savings and loan crisis in the 90s. And of course, during all of these booms and busts, that's when different regulations come about, it seems like.
Yeah, if something bad happens, you know, any new law or regulation usually happens because something bad happened.
Yeah.
You know, or somebody got sued somewhere, you know. Every little disclaimer you see on every product or anything, it's because somewhere somebody did something and got sued. You know, you're thinking, you know, the shampoo bottle says only to be used externally. It's like, well, who drinks shampoo? But, you know, somewhere somebody did and caused them to write that. So
I think there's a Bill Engvall joke about that. Here's your sign.
Here's your sign, yeah. So it's probably the same in the mortgage business, you know.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So that leads us up to what is probably the most prominent in people's minds, although except maybe with the exception of the last 6 months.
Yeah.
Is the 2000s and ultimately the 2008 crash, which led us into the Great Recession.
Right, right. Right.
So what was happening during this time? And this is kind of endemic to all booms and busts. So what was happening was there were a lot of product innovations.
I like that term, product innovations, which really means how can we figure out a new mortgage product to lend to people who don't qualify otherwise?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. That's kind of the fancy PR term of product innovation. So
no job, no problem. Product innovation.
That's great. Yeah. So what happens is, you know, we kind of go through these periods where everything's very steady. It's growing at a good clip. And, you know, people are buying houses, selling houses, starting to do investments, things like that. And things, they're very normal for a period of time. Well, then banks get to the point where, you know, they say, okay, well, we're lending at this, but all companies, banks included, are trying to continue to grow. Well, when you're trying to continue to grow, but all of your buyer pool or your borrower pool is already in some product, you've got to go out and find new clients.
New ones, right? Yeah.
So
and those at that point happen to be the people who couldn't buy a house for some reason or another.
Right, exactly. So then banks come up with these ideas, and it's not individual banks. It's really kind of the secondary market with mortgage-backed securities and things like that. But they come up with these incentivizations for these different products to help these people. So an example of that, which we touched on earlier, was the option arm in the early 2000s. So the option being you could either make the fully amortizing payment, you could make the interest only payment, or you could pay even less than that. And the additional balance would go up onto your loan,
right?
Which is where the term negative amortization comes right. from.
And ultimately bad, bad idea.
Right. Right, exactly. Because the way that product was actually intended was for somebody whose income is not necessarily stable, but they still make good money.
Right. So it fluctuates maybe.
Exactly. So an easy way to look at it is like salespeople. You know, if you have a great couple of months or like your busy season is this 3 month period and that's when you make all of your money. Well, during those periods when you're not making as much money, you're going to make the minimum payment. But then when you get those big checks coming in, that's when you're going to start applying towards principal and paying off that extra money.
Right.
Right.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because what ultimately ended up happening is people were getting qualified on that option only payment. And that's the only thing that they were paying.
Just the smallest one they could pay.
Right.
And their loans were growing and growing and growing because what they weren't paying kept getting added to the balance.
Right. And from a banking standpoint, you're probably thinking like, hey, why would banks even like offer this, right? So what banks were looking at and why they were willing to give someone a loan where they're basically just adding interest to the loan is at the time, home values were going up on average 10% per year.
They were rising really fast. So the theory right. was that the value was rising faster than the loan balance.
Exactly, yes. So if I'm charging interest at 5%, but your value's going up 10%, I can just ride that spread. And if you default, I'll just take over your home and I'll sell it on the open market and I'll still be whole.
And I'll still make money, yeah.
Right. So banks were going, hey, I mean, if you got a pulse, I'll give you a loan, right?
Yeah.
That's what people think of. That was because home values were going so far so fast during that period.
They're like, we can't lose.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and if you've ever seen the movie The Big Short, which is a great movie, and anybody who's not seen that movie, it's all about this topic of the Great Recession and what happened to the mortgage market.
Steve Carell's in that?
Yep. Steve Carell. Christian Bale is in it.
Okay.
There's a couple other big names too. And
I think I saw it on Amazon recently, so I think I'll go check that out again.
So one of the buzzwords that also occurred during this time is the popularization of the term mortgage-backed securities. So we talked about that a little bit already,
yeah,
right?
And that's where mortgages are bundled together in a product and sold on the stock market.
Right. Why that's important has to do with the secondary market, which is essentially these huge investors like insurance companies and pension funds and even like international companies. They were investing in the American housing market, essentially, from their standpoint. That's what they were looking at.
Yeah.
American home values are growing. America's a stable country. Let's go ahead and invest in America. Like that was a way for outsiders or even big national companies to be able to do that. So with mortgage-backed securities, the concept was an investor is going to come in and buy this mortgage-backed security. We know there's going to be some really good loans in there. We know there's probably going to be maybe some not so good loans in there. And then
but
the
on
middle,
average, we're going to do fine.
Right, exactly. So that was the intention. Well, what ended up happening was the ratings agencies, so like Moody's and some of these other companies, these were supposed to be independent third parties that would look at these securities that were being created and say, hey, this is a good one. So we're going to give it an A rating or a double A rating. Well, they basically stopped paying attention and they were just like, yep, okay, if you tell us that this is what the ratings are going to be, then yeah, we'll just rubber stamp it, right? So then what some of these secondary players, because it wasn't the original originators or the banks, like your local bank was not really who was causing the problems. All this stuff was happening in the secondary market, right? So what these secondary companies were doing was they would take a mortgage-backed security and they would split it up into smaller pieces. Well, they figured out a way that they could take these bad loans and then make them look good. So they were basically like putting lipstick on a pig. Mm. Well, because they were telling the ratings agencies how to rate these securities, they were getting away with it. And Moody's, who was supposed to be a independent third party, was just rubber stamping it. So then ultimately what happened, I know that's kind of wonky for somebody who's not really familiar with this subject, ultimately what ended up happening is they were putting a lot of lipstick on some pigs and investors were buying it. And then eventually everything just blew up.
Right. Because it wasn't worth what they bought it for.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
especially when all the foreclosures started happening, people couldn't make the payments on their loans anymore. And now they're holding, you know, these securities with a whole bunch of bad loans.
Right. And ultimately it was just that the cash stopped flowing. So the problem is if borrowers are not making their payments, then the servicers are not able to make the payments to investors. And it basically was just like a giant downhill effect and the snowball just getting bigger and bigger and faster and faster. And so that's why during 2008, 2009, you saw home values kind of slow down. Like they were going up so fast, they started to slow down a little bit and then they peaked and then they started to decelerate or they started to go down.
Decline, yeah.
And then what happened was the decline started getting faster and faster and faster. And that's really when everybody started to freak out because they had no idea when it was going to stop because it was going down just as fast as it was going up. So,
man,
usually that is what happens in a boom and a bust period is you see these product innovations that we were talking about earlier where banks start getting into more risk, more risk, more risk, and then eventually it all kind of blows up.
Well, I kind of feel like that's less likely to happen now. There's been so many great regulations that have been passed since then as a result of all that,
yes,
to prevent that kind of thing from happening. And that's one of the reasons guidelines are as strict as they are now, because we don't just hand out a loan to anybody with a pulse.
Right.
We are legally required to make sure that they can repay that loan. Otherwise, we can't give it to them.
Right. Right. And it's usually the pendulum effect. Everybody's heard of that, right?
Yeah, so, of course.
It gets real easy to get a loan for a while, mm-hmm. and then it gets real hard to get a loan for a while, and then it gradually goes back the other direction. And so we just kind of swing back and forth. And, you know, a lot of people are still able to get mortgages, but some of those riskier borrowers are not able to, unfortunately. But that's usually what leads to the boom and bust cycle.
Yeah, well, luckily we're in a really good spot right now. We're, I guess you'd call it a boom right now.
Yeah.
Rates are super low. They're pretty much as low as they've ever been.
Yes.
And so it's a great time to buy a house. It's a great time to refinance if you've still got a higher interest rate. So, you know, give us a shout at highknowshomeshow.com and we'll be happy to help you out with that. We need to go ahead and call it a day here, but thanks for listening. Thanks to Encyclopedia Steve for all your knowledge as always. And thanks to producer Ellen for helping put the show together. We'll see you next week on the High Knows Home Show.
Accurate Mortgage Group, a division of Acopia LLC, is an equal housing lender, NMLS 4664, and Homeowner, NMLS 1666140.